The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
My next guest points out that anger now dominates American politics. You've probably noticed. It wasn't always so. Happy days are here again was FDR's campaign song in 1932. By contrast, candidate Kamala Harris's 2020 campaign song was Mary J. Blige's Work That, Let Them Get Mad, They're Gonna Hate Anyway. Well, both the left and the right now summon anger as the main way to motivate their supporters. After the election, both sides became even more indignant. The left accuses the right of insurrection. The right accuses the left of fraud. And his book is about how we got here, about how America changed from a nation that could be roused to anger but preferred self-control to a nation permanently dialed to 11. The book is titled Wrath. And what an appropriate word for where we are today. Wrath, America Enraged. Peter Wood is the president of the National Association of Scholars and author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged, as well as last year's acclaimed 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. A former professor of anthropology and college provost, he is the author of several books about American culture, including Diversity, The Invention of a Concept, and A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now. That was back in 2007. He is the editor-in-chief of the journal Academic Questions and a widely published essayist. In 2019, he received the Jean Kilpatrick Prize for contributions to academic freedom. He's based in New York and joins us today by phone. And I am just delighted to have you with us and appreciate your book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
You write in the beginning of your book, in the section titled How to Read This Book, you write that wrath is more of an exploration than an argument. And you also write that my book reflects my uncertainty about what to do next, and I dedicate it to those who share my quandary. I have no answers, easy or otherwise, to those who seek counsel about how to recover our country from a profound betrayal by a self-serving class of powerful people. What I have is a reflection 20 years in the making on anger in America. Now, I'll just ask the simple and rather obvious question. How did anger come to dominate American politics? Is it just as recently as the last election, or has this been building over a long period of time?
Well, it's been building over a long period, at least about 25 years. I think the surprising thing that I found was that anger had found a home in American culture before it entered into politics. We tend to think of politics as the source of our polarity these days, but it's really the destination where it went after it had already taken hold in other departments of our lives. And there's a reason for that. I think politics is by itself so fraught with the possibility of anger that people over the generations have built into it safeguards, things that were meant to enable politicians to argue with each other on the floor of the Senate, but then go out and have coffee afterwards and talk things over. That set of safeguards, the circuit breakers that kept politics from becoming all rage all the time, has gone away. So what we have now is what politics looks like when the safeguards are removed. And I see this as something that has happened across the board. It's not one side or the other that is more responsible for the anger. But that doesn't mean that the anger is exactly the same on either side as well. We've got a distinct character to the anger of the left and a distinct character to the anger on the right. And the two of them, when they clash, produce yet something else, a breakdown, I would say, of basic civility in American life we're all experiencing that in one way or another. I've experienced it firsthand in my own church, and it's a question of whether people can disagree without that getting in the way of a common worship. And sometimes the answer is no, they can't. And there are issues we have to deal with because of that.
What are the pillars that we have abandoned that make civility sort of an arcane notion that is no longer where we hope to ultimately arrive?
What are the issues? Well, the
pillars that we once relied upon.
Well, the pillar we once relied on was the notion that we should engage in self-government, self-control. That is, we govern our individual emotions and souls, and we also govern ourselves collectively as people who share a commitment to that form of self-control. Now, that was once so common that it hardly needed to be remarked. Mm-hmm. For centuries, our country focused on teaching people not only self-reliance, but self-control. People did have tempers. They lost them at times. Anger is a human emotion that is bound to crop up. The question is not whether they get angry, but what happens when they get angry. Do they figure out, I've got to put some guards against this, I have to stop at some point? For how many hundreds of years, 200 at least, George Washington was the figure that we look to as the father of the country. We tend to think of him as somebody who was staid and dignified and not very exciting, but his contemporaries knew the opposite. He was a man who had a terrific temper. His achievement was that he learned to control it. And when he found himself about to burst his bounds, he was able to draw back and take command of himself. His ability to do that is what gave him command over other people around him. That lesson had been relearned many times over the course of our country's history, and one would have thought it was settled. But after World War II, things began to come apart, I think in two ways. One was that's when Americans really began to discover Freudian psychoanalysis, with the idea that if you repress your anger, it will come back at you in the form of neurosis. So it was more healthy mentally to let it all out. And the other was the importation from Europe after the war of existentialism and an idea that to have an authentic life, you had to be in touch with your darkest emotions and let them out. So those two things were circulating at around the same time in the early 1950s, mostly on the coastal elites, but gradually they spread throughout the rest of society. It's a long story. I won't try to tell it on this interview, but I think what you see happening is that the licensing of anger, this new mm-hmm. form of individualism, gains ground because it proves to be such a useful tool for protest. People begin to understand that being angry empowers them and excites other people. Anger becomes something of a spectator sport, and that's one of the first places we really see it, is that sports, which used to be governed by codes of sportsmanship, suddenly become places where people swear and brawl, and it turns out to be one way in which you can make anger into something that is both more lived experience and less controlled. We saw it happening in our mass media, our movies, even in our music, and angrification takes place that sweeps through culture. Key to all of that is the way we bring up children. If you teach children at a young age, you have to control yourself. It's different from just letting them have their tantrums and sometimes letting them have their ways. As parental generations adopted the idea that expressive individualism is better, it's kind of morally better than self-control, you begin to get people whose whole lives are open to the mad swings of anger from one moment to the next. So all of that had been happening for 40 or 50 years before we decided that we would make it part of our politics as well. And I think the crucial years for those changes are starting in the 1990s, when during the Clinton years there was a lot of denunciation going on of the angry white man. But then it really, the dam breaks with George Bush's election over Kerry in 2000. After that, you find an angry left emerging that is just exuberant in its anger. And that's something new. People have gotten angry before, but now it's something to take pride in. Look how angry I am. Join me. We're going to have an anger fest. And that coincides pretty closely with the rise of social media, so that people could get online and begin to egg each other on from early in the morning. So it's a bit hard to tease these things apart, but the political anger and the ostentatious anger on social media begin to form a feedback loop, and they accelerate. That's the stuff that was happening when I wrote my first book about anger, A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now. I wrote that back in 2006. And I was taking account of this stuff and saying that we really need to get control of it, because this is not going to lead to any place good. Well, counsel like that seldom is heeded, and I guess I didn't really expect it to be, but I also didn't expect it to accelerate to the degree that it has. We have now turned our politics into nothing but anger, a kind of animosity towards the guys on the other side has become the signature of what it means to engage in political life. No will to find a common way is left. And I have to confess that I share that. I don't see now how you can create a meaningful compromise between people who want the country to have no borders and people who want the borders to be enforced, or people who believe that a woman's right to choose trumps everything, and people who think that the right to life trumps everything. Those are not matters to be settled by a handshake. We have a world right now in which the division between those who think the 2020 election was stolen and those who call that the big lie can't really even talk about it.
Each side
gets boiling mad at the other once the opposing idea is put on the table.
I wanted to ask, progressive elites are stoking rage on a range of issues, from anti-racism, critical race theory, efforts to erase American history, the 1619 Project, one example, unfettered illegal immigration, the COVID pandemic response, new voter rights comparisons. What are the risks of losing emotional self-control and the consequences of a culture that indulges too freely in the celebration of anger? And what kind of threat does that pose to the republic?
Well, that's a hefty question. I would say that all the things you're talking about are backed up with emotional rage. If you try to engage in reasoned argument with somebody who holds the positions that you just listed, you don't get reasoned argument in return. What you get is a kind of denunciation. You're a racist, you're a xenophobe, you're homophobe, you're some kind of person whose own views are reduced to a pathological, psychological state. So what do you get when you license anger to be the tool by which you proceed through disagreements with other people? Well, what you don't get is argument. What you do get is a effort to write the person out of the conversation altogether. The result of that on the political scale means that tens of millions of people are denied the right to participate in their own government. The idea of consent of the governed, which is intrinsic to our republic, disappears because the governed, in this case, can only be controlled or suppressed. Now, we're talking about a big range of issues. Each of those things is sort of compacted into an ideology in which the view is that social justice, or so-called social justice, lies on one side, and on the other side, there only is this category of the ignorant, the deplorable, those who gravitate towards fascist dictatorship. Terms of abuse that don't really describe what anybody believes at all. Since it's extremely difficult to find anybody who's an actual racist, we have this new concept of systemic racism, which can be applied across the board, regardless of what a person really believes or stands for. That is a kind of pollution of the world of a democratic polity. You can't really engage in politics if you're going to be denounced as subhuman for disagreeing with anything that stands in the form of enforced doctrine by the governing party. Well, I'm saying the governing party, of course, can change. And we are now in this situation where we face a government that, in my view, was elected by, let's say, mischief, actions taken that didn't fully comport with the rule of law, has brought in President Biden and Vice President Harris. They have been able to use the levers of government to advance the kinds of policies you're talking about. We have simply no border enforcement now at all. We bugged out of Afghanistan, abandoning friends and citizens, as well as billions of dollars of equipment. All that sort of thing rankles, but if you try to express it in the mainstream media in America, you will find yourself not just cut down in that act, but perhaps prohibited from appearing anywhere else. We have these incredibly powerful things like Facebook and Twitter, which seem to have a capacity to say you don't exist. If we disagree with you, we will prohibit you from expressing any views at all on our platform. And since all the platforms interlock with one another, it really creates a class of non-citizens. So when I say that in these circumstances, I share in the anger. I understand where the wrath of the right comes from. It comes from being denied participation in your own society. The real question in my mind is, what can we do to prevent this wrath from descending into to violence or mere anarchy, or worse, perhaps despair, the despair of the person who just gives up and retreats into some kind of bleak inner world. I much favor that we take our wrath and turn it to as constructive an end as we can. That may mean winning elections or participating more fully in local politics, but it may also mean simply engaging in civil disobedience, saying that there's some things you can't make me do. While I myself have been vaccinated, when I see people who refuse to be vaccinated because they think that's a illegal or improper intrusion of the state on their personal privacy, I'm perfectly good with that. I think that's a worthy act. It comes with some risks of how you will be dealt with by the authorities, but you're making a statement there that makes some sense in pushing back against an authoritarian regime that wants to turn everything we do into a matter of state policy.
Well, I appreciate that. In addition to describing where we are as a country, as a culture, with regard to anger, that you also offer advice that wrath is a dangerous weapon. You have to use it wisely to avoid self-injury, and that it needs to be used constructively in overcoming things like, as you pointed out, censorship and silencing and criminalization of dissenting opinion, other forms of persecution. What encouragement can you give our listeners as our time is ticking away who recognize and will immediately recognize what you write about in the book, but want to do something different, to be constructive, to perhaps move the Republic in a direction that's more more constructive and favorable to a future?
Well, I took heart from the school board elections and state elections that occurred this month, especially in Virginia, but also in New Jersey, here where I am in New York, where there was a real sign that the public is sufficiently fed up to push back against this. That's one thing. When I see people resisting, as in air traffic controllers or airline pilots, or again in New York, it's been nurses and doctors and firefighters and policemen who have put some brakes on this. Whatever we do for a living, we have some opportunity to exert ourselves beyond just our individual choices and to influence other people. Maybe the hardest thing of all to do is to bring this into your actual community, your friends, relations, people that you go to church with. I'm in the midst of that now, and I live in a deep blue part of New York City. I'm in Upper West Side. I'm surrounded by people who strongly disagree with my every opinion. And yet I try to pick my way through that by showing people that I can disagree with them without becoming a monster. But I don't want to give up my right to dissent. And I think that that's a hard choice that we each have to make individually about where you're going to dissent and how you're going to do it. And sometimes the results are just not very nice. You lose friends, or in one of my cases, a group at church just broke up because people couldn't stand knowing, not even expressing, that others held different views. I think it's important that that kind of thing actually happen, that you don't live in fear of it happening to the point where you begin to compromise away your right to self-expression.
Yeah.
I don't encourage people to be antagonistic, but I do encourage them to be thoughtfully forceful in maintaining their opinions against peer pressure.
Yeah, great advice. Well, the book is really a must read, Wrath, America Enraged. I wish we had more time because there's so much more to talk about, but I would highly recommend it. It's published by Encounter. And Peter Wood, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.